This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. The Concord Monitor recently devoted a week of coverage to homelessness, a subject of huge conversation in the capital city and likewise in other cities around the state. In a series of reports, the paper examined topics ranging from changes in the homeless population to strategies like housing first to the thorny question of whether Concord's relative generosity has made it a magnet for homeless people. The Monitor series came just as the state's annual homeless count shared some good news that overall, the number of Granite Staters without a permanent roof over their heads is down by about 3% over the past year. Especially welcome was a decline in homeless families, but the report also showed increases among certain subgroups like veterans and so-called chronic homeless. Today in The Exchange, who's homeless in New Hampshire and how do the state and its communities respond? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in the studio. Jeremy Blackman is here, staff reporter at The Monitor, which, as I said, produced a recent in-depth report on homelessness in the city. And Jeremy, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much.
Also with us, Keith Howard, executive director of Liberty House, a transitional housing facility for veterans in Manchester. Howard himself is formerly homeless and a veteran. And Keith Howard, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Kathy Kuhn, director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness and director of research and training at Families in Transition, a homeless service provider. And Kathy, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks, Laura.
Well, and Kathy, I want to start with you since you had that big report toward the end of last year. What do you pull out of the report? What stands out for you as someone who works in this field?
You know, so obviously, you know, I think the biggest point is that we are continuing the trend of overall declines in homelessness. That trend started in 2011. And over the last year, we saw another 3% decrease in overall homelessness. That's good news. I think some of that is a result of the improving economy. We see our service providers continuing to do excellent work to serve the homeless in the community. As you said, though, we did see some increases in certain segments of certain subpopulations of the homeless. So obviously it's a significant concern that we're seeing increases in our chronically homeless population. Over the last year, it was a pretty significant, a 44% increase in our chronically homeless population.
Well, that's a lot.
It is a lot. And, you know, and it's a concern because what the research says is that although this is a small segment of the homeless population, they do tend to use, you know, the majority of the shelter resources, and not just the shelter resources, but also sort of our community resources. So, you know, in terms of resources in the criminal justice system or police encounters or, you know, in healthcare and emergency room visits. So it can be, you know, a very expensive endeavor to have these folks out on the streets.
So small group, big impact, and big increase in their numbers.
And big increase in their number over the last year.
Well, and before we go too much further, Kathy, it's so tricky, right? I mean, how do you define homelessness? If I'm couch surfing, you know, from friend to friend, relative to relative, I'm not homeless, but I certainly don't have a house.
Yeah, that's very true. And that's one of the challenges that we have with the data. So various agencies have different definitions of homelessness. And the Department of Housing and Urban Development tends to have a fairly narrow definition of homeless. So the folks that you just described would not be considered homeless under the Department of Housing and Urban Development definition. So the numbers that we're seeing right now aren't including those folks that are doubled up. And, you know, many service providers really feel that that's a problem because, you know, really, when you're living doubled up and when you don't know where you're going to spend the next night, that's homeless. And that cannot, you know, some people say that can often be more stressful than actually being in the shelter system. At least when you're in the shelter, you're connected to resources. You know where you're going to spend the next night. When you're not in the shelter, you're going from place to place. You're really isolated, and that can be very, very stressful and oftentimes have very negative impacts for individuals and families.
Well, one more question. We're going to focus a lot this hour on these two subgroups that you mentioned, Kathy, that veterans and chronic homeless. But I was impressed to see good news in the decline among homeless kids. That's been a big concern. Mm,
it's a huge concern, yes. So for the first time in many, many years, we did see a 1%, fairly small, but nonetheless a little bit of a decrease in the numbers that we received from the Department of Education. Now, those numbers that we received from the Department of Education actually do include people who are kids who are doubled up.
Oh, so we got a little apples and oranges problem.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. The other thing is that that number is it's about 3,200 children, if I'm not mistaken. So that number is also, you know, those are kids that are doubled up. So it's a fairly large number.
All right. Well, and Keith, I did want to turn to you because, as I said, executive director of Liberty House, a housing facility for veterans in Manchester. Why do you think, Keith, veterans are one of those groups that is not seeing a decline in homelessness?
I wish I knew, Laura. I wish I knew. I can only draw upon the folks that we have at Liberty House, 60 folks over the past couple of years. And while the typical picture of homeless vet is somebody who's just gotten out of the service, typically we're seeing folks who are 40 to 60 years old who may not have kept up with vocational skills to be able to hold down jobs that are going to be able to support themselves. So I don't know what it is exclusively or specifically about veterans that makes them more likely to be homeless.
So the image of a homeless veteran is what, Keith?
I would say that the image of a homeless veteran is somebody, a combat vet who has come back, doesn't have skills that are useful in the civilian economy, and then is out on the street. That's not what we're seeing. And I think that part of that ties back to what you were saying with doubling up, that when you're a vet who is in his or her 20s or early 30s, it's much more natural to be couch surfing, staying with somebody for a period of time. By the time you get into your 40s, you don't have friends who are willing to have you come and kind of hang out with them. So there may be a whole population of vets in their 20s who, if we broadened the definition of homeless, would be homeless, but we're not seeing them because they've got buddies they can stay with.
How much are you seeing veterans, Keith, struggling with substance abuse issues as a result of trauma that they might have encountered during their service time?
As a recovering alcoholic myself, I'm hesitant to say what it is that causes people to use drugs and alcohol. There certainly seems to be a correlation. We see a lot of folks who have been traumatized by combat who end up drinking and drugging, but we also see folks who had perfectly peaceful periods in the military and are still using drugs and alcohol.
Well, and I know in the Monitor series, and I'll ask you about this in a minute, Jeremy, that substance abuse is a big issue. But one more question, if I could, Keith. You're quite open about this. You're formerly homeless yourself. I wish people could see you. You look very dapper. You have a lovely shirt on and a beautiful tie and so forth. You don't look like a formerly homeless person.
What should a formerly homeless person look like?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Tell us how you came to that spot.
Well, I had worked in education for about 20 years, running alternative schools in three different communities in the state. And my drinking, which had always been an issue for me, I let it out of control so that I ended up not being able to work in education anymore. And then basically just kept on drinking and drinking until I was homeless and stealing mouthwash to drink from dollar stores because dollar stores don't have great security. So you can go in and find alcohol and mouthwash. And so by the end of my drinking, that was my drink of choice, was mouthwash. I was lucky enough that I had a moment of clarity when I was planning on going off and walking the Appalachian Trail and committing suicide on the trail, had a moment of clarity and recognized that even though I had not used any of my veterans' benefits, that as a veteran I could go to the VA hospital in Manchester. I walked in there to the emergency room and said, "Hi, my name's Keith Howard. I don't really want to be alive anymore." And that was a good way to get attention inside an emergency room. And so from that moment, I was sent by ambulance to White River Junction, medically detoxed there, and then was introduced to a self-help program that has helped me to stay sober for the past 7 years.
Wow, that's an amazing story.
Yeah, well, and I, like Lou Gehrig, I feel like I'm the luckiest man on the face of the planet because every day I get paid to go in and interact with folks who have reached that same dropping off point.
Well, and again, Liberty House, also, if you want to know more, has a podcast of interviews with residents, former residents, and staff. You can find a link to the podcast from our website, nhpr.org/exchange. More stories like Keith Howard's there. Jeremy, Concord has struggled with this chronically homeless population that Kathy mentioned. Another group, along with veterans, it doesn't seem to be pulling out of this. You met some of these folks. Tell us about them, Jeremy. Why were they chronically homeless?
Well, I think it's important to kind of go over the definition of what a chronically homeless person is. And under the federal definition, that is a person who's been homeless for a year or more and has a debilitating circumstance, so substance abuse or mental health challenging problem, or they've been homeless for 4 times in the past 3 years. And Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong in any of that.
Nope.
But I think that, you know, there's no way of really telling why the chronically homeless numbers are increasing in Merrimack County, but there are some correlations that we can really point to. One is we have the state prison, and we have the halfway house. We also have the women's halfway house. Their prison is in Goffstown, but it's coming to Concord. Mental health services are down over the last couple of years in Merrimack County. And we also have this unique situation where we have these winter shelters that have emerged a decade ago.
First Church and South
Congregational Church. Yeah, and I think they take in a lot of different circumstances, and I think that's definitely correlated with the increase in numbers of people.
All right, we will talk a lot more about that after a short break and hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. More on homelessness in the Granite State in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at homelessness in the Granite State and some of the possible ways out that the state is looking at. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. What do you see in terms of this problem in your own community? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Your questions, comments, observations about homelessness are welcome today in The Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. With us in studio, Kathy Kuhn, Director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness, Keith Howard, Executive Director of Liberty House, a transitional housing facility for veterans in Manchester, and Jeremy Blackman, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor, which recently produced an in-depth series on homelessness in the capital city. You can find links to that series on our website at nhpr.org/exchange. And Jeremy, back to you for just a moment, if I could. We were talking about chronically homeless. This is one of the two groups that Kathy's group has found is doing worse, even though the overall number of homeless people in New Hampshire is down, and that's good news. You talked about defining chronically homeless, for a year straight or 4 times over the past 3 years. Talk a little bit more, Jeremy, about some of the chronically homeless folks that you met. Who they were, why they felt that they were stuck in that situation.
Sure. Well, that project actually just, that project started out of in 2013, we've had some major camps in Concord, and we really wanted to look at, because in 2013, those camps were cleared out, they were on state property, and we wanted to see last year what had changed, where a lot of those people had gone, and whether or not the overall population had really decreased in that time. And we just started meeting so many different people in camps that were are kind of makeshift now down by the railroads, and also going just morning after morning to the resource center here, the local resource center. And I think that, you know, it goes without saying that there are so many different ways that you can come to homelessness. And it's one thing to know that, but it's another to really get to meet all these different people and hear their different stories. And
what's a story that stuck out for you, someone that you met among this group where you just went, wow, how is this person ever going to get out of this?
Well, there was actually a pair that comes out, sticks out in my mind, and they're both gentlemen in their mid-40s, early 50s, and they live in one of Harold's car. They live out of the car and during the warmer months, and they go to our local temporary shelters during the winter, and it's become a routine. They met about 2 years ago. Wendell is a former sex – well, he is a sex offender, and he got out of prison. There's two ways to come out of prison. One, you can parole, and you have to check in with a parole officer. The other is to max out. And in that instance, you come out of prison, and you really have no safety net. You're just, you know, given your things and see you later. And that's how he came to homelessness. He immediately started camping out. Harold comes from a different story. He lost his job, and they met each other at the soup kitchen and become fast friends. Harold can get into housing. He actually has gotten into housing, but Wendell cannot because of his sex offenses. And Harold refuses to live without Wendell. They're each other's family at this point. And so it was really interesting to see that dynamic and to understand that, you know, someone who's been given housing doesn't want to take it because they have this relationship with another person. And it really is just kind of illustrates all the different difficulties with that. Someone with a past criminal conviction, it's so difficult to find a job. It's so difficult to find housing. And even if you do find housing, oftentimes the rent is exorbitant.
So it's easy to look at that person and say, get a job. But if you have a criminal record, no one wants to hire you.
Right. And I think it's also important to know that a lot of times there is culpability on the person itself. It's not always, you know, woe is me. A lot of times people aren't willing to take, responsibility for the challenge and the obstacles that they need to overcome personally. And substance abuse is a huge part of that, and I think that we saw a lot of that as well.
Yeah, and at that Liberty House, right, Keith Howard, you don't take people who are actively using drugs or alcohol.
Right. We maintain zero tolerance for that. And just want to touch on something that Jeremy mentioned about the difficulties of finding a job when you have a criminal record. Some of our best success stories are folks who are convicted felons. In fact, one person who maxed out 25 years for second-degree murder is currently working about 25 hours a week in the community, and then we've just hired him to do paperwork and to help folks get set up with Medicaid eligibility stuff. But I think it does take a special kind of employer to give somebody a shot, and we're lucky enough to have developed a network so that we know employers who are more likely to give somebody a break. And once you're working, you become much more attractive to other employers. It's when you have no history of working, you are a convict, and there's nobody that's going to take that shot.
Kathy, I have a question for you, too, but I want to bring our listeners into our conversation as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Your observations about homelessness in your community and in New Hampshire, your thoughts about why it happens and possible solutions to make it not as bad as it is. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Allison's in Concord. Hi, Allison. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I live in Concord, and I shop a lot at the Fort Eddy Plaza, and there's a lot of people panhandling there, and I feel uncomfortable just giving people cash, but I would like to help. I'm not, you know, I feel cold and callous kind of driving by, but I feel like cash maybe isn't the most helpful thing, because your guests give people an idea how they can help.
Panhandling, a big issue in Concord. And Jeremy, actually, you guys, that's part of what got you guys into this series, right?
Yeah, well, that was in conjunction with the camps being disbanded.
Right.
The city imposed a ban on panhandling. So if you actually do give out that dollar to a person, it can really harm them in the long run, because you know, they can be given a citation.
Yeah, it's a violation now, yeah, with a fine or right, jail time or something like that. So Kathy, Allison, shouldn't give the person anything.
Well, you know, Allison can do what she wants, but you know, just know that there is that that risk, and you know, a lot of people still do it, and it's their way of getting their daily cash for food or for other things.
Yeah, it was interesting after that panhandling law was passed. For a little while, Jeremy, you saw a decline around the shopping centers, but then it kind of came back.
Yeah, I really haven't noticed much of a change.
Kathy, what would you say to Allison?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with Jeremy in that I think to some extent it is a personal decision, you know, what you decide to do. But in general, we really tell people not to give to panhandlers to some extent because some of them aren't homeless at all. And so, you know, you really have no idea where that money is going and whether or not that they really need that money. So in general, we tell folks to give to social service agencies, and that way you know exactly where that money is going and that you know it's going to really provide long-term solutions for those folks.
Here's another question I wanted to ask you, Kathy, and this comes from, again, the Concord Monitor series. They interviewed a police officer who broke up some of the camps, you know, down by the river. Here's this gentleman. He says, Mike Bernier, 12 years ago, he said, homelessness in and around Concord was predominantly economic driven. He talks about how sort of neat and tidy and organized these camps were. Now, he says, it's mental illness, it's alcoholism, it's medical issues, it's PTSD, it's domestic violence, it's sex offenders, it's drug addiction. He says it's not what it was. And I read this and I said, how are homeless advocates like you, Kathy, you know, even supposed to get your arms around that? It's so big. I mean, finding people an apartment is hard enough, and then you have all this other stuff.
It is. It's a huge, complex problem. And so it requires the commitment of so many folks in the community, so many service providers in the community. You know, the economics of homelessness still exists. Homelessness is still about poverty and about the lack of affordable housing. So we don't have enough housing in our community for folks to be able to access. But it is about more than that. You know, we need the mental health services. The services are so important to make sure that people are not only able to attain the housing, but that they're able to maintain that housing. And so it's the homeless service providers that are out there and they're providing the housing. They also are, you know, doing their best to provide as many services as they can. And then, of course, to collaborate with all of those, you know, the mental health agencies and others who are providing these other key resources for the folks that we serve.
Jeremy.
Yeah, and I just wanted to jump in. We had spoken with Reverend David Keller, who helped start those emergency shelters in Concord. And one of the things that he said that stuck out with me was, you know, it's really about limiting expectations and recognizing successes. And I think that that's really important when you're looking at the broad scope of, you know, there are all these challenges. It's an insurmountable mountain of obstacles. And I think it's really important to focus on the individual case studies and cases themselves. And, you know, in Concord, the city has really focused on eliminating chronic homelessness. And for
that's
us,
the toughest nut to crack, though.
Well, and it's the biggest drain on resources. It is a tough nut to crack. But in Concord, you know, that's a few dozen people. That's about 30 to 45 people. And so that, if you look at the grand scale of homelessness, it's a, you know, looming problem. But if you look at it on the scale of 35 people trying to get those people into housing, that's something that you can really kind of wrap your mind around, I think.
Keith, I want you to follow up on something Jeremy said earlier, talking about the people that he met when they did this series at the Concord Monitor. Jeremy said, you know, some of these cases, it's clear that the people themselves have made bad choices, not taking responsibility for their actions now that they're in this situation. I wonder, as someone who's dealing on the front lines with people, your thoughts on the role of personal responsibility when it comes to pulling yourself out of this.
Okay. I will respond to that in one second, but I just want to refer back to the quote that you gave. It seems to me that it's easy to romanticize the past, and we talk about the golden age of homelessness. The homeless 10 years ago, they were so much better. It's interesting that when we look at the hobos of the 1930s, there's a lot of romanticization about that. If you go back and look at contemporary accounts, hobos were not seen as being the knights of the road. They were seen as being criminals and a dangerous element that came to your town. So I don't know that the homeless population has changed as much as it might feel to those of us who were here, because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 50 years ago, a lot of the ugliness has kind of drifted away from those things. And you remember the funny stories about, you know, Mudslide Slim, who traveled the rails. Not that Mudslide Slim also broke into houses and would steal booze.
Yeah, so, that's an important point.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. The other question.
The other question. Personally, and as an agency, Liberty House does believe that each and every one of us is responsible for finding ways out of whatever trick bag we found ourselves in. So that not looking at laying blame, but that wherever a person is, he or she needs to be willing to do the work to get out of there. And that's Liberty House really does focus on people, veterans, men and women. Right now we have 8 men, 1 woman, but focuses on folks who may be in the water in danger of drowning, but not the folks who have gone down 3 times, which is really more the chronically homeless question that we're looking at, is people who have lost most of their connection to mainstream society. We're focusing on helping people repair relationships that still exist instead of people who, you know, have been living on the streets for so long that they may not have any emotional resources to draw on.
So you're working with folks who maybe have a capacity to move on.
Right, right. I mean, a third of our folks come directly from the streets. A third come from drug and alcohol rehabs, and a third come from prison. And honestly, we are most successful with those folks who come to us directly from prison for whatever reason. They're people who can say, yes, I have paid my debt to society, even though they come out with some strikes against them being convicted felons. They also are recognizing that they're being given a fresh start. The same thing with folks who have freed themselves from drugs and alcohol. They are coming to us recognizing, okay, this is a redeal of my life. People who have been living on the streets for the chronically homeless, it's a lot harder to say you are now in a new place and you can recreate your life.
A lot of those people just can't imagine what life is like.
The chronically homeless.
Yeah, we met one person and I asked him straight up. He was drinking while we were talking, and I asked him, you know, if getting into housing required you to give up doing that, would you be willing to do that? And his response wasn't that I think I can't or I don't want to. It was that, you know, well, actually it was I don't think I can at this point. I've been doing it for so long. He just doesn't really imagine what life is like without that. And when all your friends are drinking, there's no intervention and there's no real kind of glimpse of
Of another alternative.
Of another alternative. Exactly.
Let's go back to our listeners. Jonathan's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Jonathan. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning, Laura. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Good morning. When we know that people, you know, he's talking about the percentage of people get out and how, you know, they have to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and that's definitely true. We don't take into account the number of mentally ill there. That, of course, after 88, you know, that's very difficult for some of them to find their way out of the hole. But the most interesting thing I read about homelessness recently was Salt Lake City's solution to the program problem, which is a program that it used to cost them $22,000 to $24,000 a year per homeless person for basic shelters and services. And now they provide each person with a small home, and it costs them $15,000. And the programs can then focus on people getting back to work, those who are mentally capable and getting off drugs, those who are addicted. And I know that would never happen in New Hampshire, being someone who grew up here. People would have a fit at the idea that somehow these people are getting away with it, even though nobody wants to be homeless and nobody wants to be poor. But it works. $15,000 a year, and the homeless situation is nil.
Well, Jonathan, I read that article. Yeah, it's called Housing First, Kathy, and it's a big debate in the homeless service provider community. Give us a little bit more on what it is.
Sure. So Housing First is really sort of a methodology of providing or a manner of providing permanent supportive housing. So in the past, what's happened is that many service providers across the country and in New Hampshire have provided services really sort of based on a model of what we call housing readiness. So that means that a person would come in, they would get assessed, their needs would be identified, and then service providers would work with them to address those needs really before they entered housing. And the idea is that so that, you know, when they do enter housing, they're ready and they're able to maintain that housing. Housing First really sort of turns that idea on its head. And really what Housing First is about is it's really a model of homeless assistance that focuses on taking people directly from the streets and placing them into permanent housing. So the gentleman...
No questions asked. Just
right, no questions asked. No preconditions. Housing is not based on any preconditions, whether you're sober, whether you're not, whether you're taking your medications, whether you're not, whether you have a criminal background or not.
Well, and Jonathan, our caller, says in Utah they've saved money doing this. So I'll ask you how they might have done that after a break, Kathy. Okay. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, following up on this conversation about homelessness, we'll talk about poverty more broadly in New Hampshire and in the United States. Send us an email before the show at exchange@nhpr.org. Join us tomorrow for that conversation. Today, again, we're looking at homelessness and some of the new numbers surrounding homelessness in the Granite State that shows the number of people without a permanent roof over their heads is continuing to decline, although there are stubborn increases in certain subgroups, the chronically homeless and veterans. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Keith Howard, Kathy Kuhn, Jeremy Blackman, before we go back to our callers and emailers, I did want to let you finish up, Kathy, on this idea of housing first. You explained it's kind of turns the old model on its head. It used to be housing readiness. You know, clean yourself up, get stable, get drug or alcohol free, and then we can help you find housing. Housing First says, here are the keys.
Right. So it's, you know, one method of providing services. When we say that here are the keys, I guess I should follow up on that personal responsibility question, because it's not just here's the keys. You know, I think there's a misconception there and that we're just sort of giving housing away and people don't have to follow any rules. And that's certainly not the case. People in a Housing First model certainly need to follow the rules of tenancy. You know, so they need to be sure that they're keeping up their units, that they're not having friends over at all hours of the night. You know, those sorts of things that the parents paying the rent, you know, those sorts of things that could get someone evicted. And so, you know, part of that comes with the services that need to be provided for folks who are in Housing First. So it's people who have lived on the street for a very long time may not have the life skills that they need to be able to keep up an apartment and to maintain their tenancy. And so the services that are attached in a Housing First model are just so key in making that model work. But the research shows that it is extremely effective.
And why is it effective?
I think because, you know,
versus the old way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're getting people off the streets. And so one of the biggest arguments for it is that it actually saves money, right? So there has been a lot of research done that says that, you know, if you can put people into permanent supportive housing, you actually save the community a lot. You can save the community a lot of money in terms of, you know, less utilization of all of those publicly funded services, like, you know, police encounters and hospital visits and emergency room visits and, you know, interactions with the correctional system. So getting people housed can really lead to, you know, great efficiencies in the community and cost savings.
It sounds like you support this then, Kathy.
Yeah, you know, I do.
Because it's controversial.
Should people, you know, should communities implement housing first? Yes, it is an evidence-based model of service provision. I guess what I would say, though, is that, you know, it is one model. You know, it's not the only model. And so it serves a relatively small, it's designed to serve a relatively small segment of the homeless population, about 20% here in New Hampshire. So that leaves 80% of the homeless that we also need to be sure that we're responding to their needs as well. So we need a range of tools, a range of services to be able to meet sort of the totality of the homeless problem in New Hampshire.
Well, I know this is a big conversation. So Keith Howard, I want to hear from you on this, and you too, Jeremy. Keith, how do you feel about Housing First?
Well, I agree with everything that Kathy said while disagreeing with her conclusion. I guess when I think of the deinstitutionalization movement for the mentally ill back in the 1970s and 1980s, that was going to save lots of money, and folks were going to be taken out of institutions where there would be tons of supportive services in their home community. The Housing First model is really successful when it's implemented with intensive case management and all kinds of support services. My concern in a state like New Hampshire is that folks focusing on how do we save money will say, oh, yeah, we'll go ahead and provide that stuff without actually allocating money for it. So then what you've really done is just kind of created boxes for folks to live in and not helped them be able to get back into the mainstream. So if Housing First were going to be implemented the way that it was, you know, normed on, the way that we're looking at results from, I would say, wow, what a great model. I don't think it's realistic in New Hampshire that would continue. Instead, at Liberty House, what we're trying to do is help folks build a bridge back into the mainstream of society. My concern is that Housing First, if it were to be implemented here, would be basically building a bridge for folks to live under instead of going back into mainstream society.
So feeling cynical, Keith, that this idea would be fully implemented in the way that it is supposed to be.
Right. And we don't have any evidence of what badly implemented Housing First does. The research is all on following the model exactly. I don't think that's likely to happen on an ongoing basis.
Jeremy, this was a big point of conversation in your series.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, with that case management, what that really is ideally, what that looks like, I think, is when you get someone into housing and that really shows them that alternative that we talked about earlier. And then you have someone meeting constantly with this person and helping them set up goals. You know, you want to reestablish a relationship with your daughter or your children. Why do you think that they don't want to talk to you or want to see you anymore? And then, you know, maybe that leads into my substance abuse is a problem and I need to stop drinking. Maybe I'll do that once a week. And I think that's really the ideal way that it would work.
You went to Maine and looked at their
housing
first
program.
And we went to
Portland and saw that on the ground. And that was a really enlightening experience just because we saw both sides of it. You know, there were two different facilities that we went and toured. In one, we went and met a man who's 60 and has a spotless apartment, better than my apartment, I would say. And, you know, he has done everything right and he has turned his life around. And then we went across the street and we're going to go look at some other units and met a woman in the lobby who stopped the director of their housing program there and said, you know, have you heard about all the police visits that we've been having, the feces in the laundry room, all the woes that neighbors are like so often citing when they have opposition to this. And so I think that it's – you need to recognize that without case management, and even with case management, there are going to be a lot of hiccups.
You're nodding, Kathy.
Oh, I fully agree. Absolutely. This is it's a challenging program, and I agree with you, Keith. I don't think we disagree at all. The way that the programs are implemented is so important, and you absolutely need to have those services available. Yeah.
Let's take another call. This is Shelley in Concord. Hi, Shelley. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Well, I'm just glad you're having this program. And long story short, I've been doing my own research on the topic of poverty and hunger for a long time. And I guess, my major question, I think, for the panel, which these people are doing really great things, and I just wanted to say, I think, the only way of looking at people in need and asking for help is with love and compassion. So if somebody's asking me for money and I need and I have it, I'm certainly going to give it to them, and I don't really care. I don't put much thought into how they're going to use it. But my question is, in my research, I found there's...
Shelley, you still there?
Hello?
Go ahead, Shelley. I think we lost you there for a second. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I've heard, I think that there's just over 400 agencies in the state of New Hampshire alone that work with hunger and poverty every day. So I think certainly there's going to always be homelessness and poverty. Oh, dear.
Okay. Well, Shelley, thank you. Yeah. And I have heard, I think I know where she's going with this, Kathy, 400 agencies in a little state like New Hampshire. Maybe there's some overlap, some duplication of effort, and just wondering, gosh, we have so many people working on this. Why isn't it better?
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot, there are a lot of agencies working on it, and I think we need a lot of agencies working on it because it is a big issue. But I think there's a lot of collaboration that's going on with these agencies. And so we have three continuums of care. These are networks of homeless service providers in the state. And these continuums of care get together to plan and to, make plans for how we're going to solve the issue of homelessness in our communities. And it's really about, looking at the entire homeless problem in a specific community and determining what resources are needed and how do those resources need to be allocated. And so agencies and continuums of care are working very hard at making sure that services aren't duplicated and that at the same time the totality of the need is met.
Well, and we should say again, just to remind everybody, that there was some good news. So you could say you're having an impact, right? I mean, a decline in 3% last year, following up a smaller decline the year before. So the numbers are going in the right direction. Jeremy, did you want to jump in?
Yeah. Well, you have to remember that New Hampshire is also a lot of it is very rural. And those continuums of care, there are three of them, but two of them are just Manchester and Nashua. So the third is everything else.
What does that mean, continuum of care?
Oh, continuum care is basically that is a region that is under the federal classification. So all the federal dollars are divvied up among those continuums of care. So the Manchester continuum of care gets a certain amount of dollars from the federal government, and then all of the rest of us, what was called the balance of state, which
so
includes Concord, Seacoast,
and everyone else.
Everything.
Wow, that doesn't really seem fair. I mean,
well,
Manchester gets some, Nashville gets some, and then wow.
Yeah. So.
But things are so stretched out, sometimes it takes more to get to people.
Oh, yeah,
when you're
absolutely
trying to cover a larger area.
Well, and Kathy can probably talk to this, but the grant that Families in Transition just got is for, I believe, 12 chronically homeless people, and to put them into housing and then have enough funding for a case manager. But that is for the balance of state. So that's 12 people in that entire region that's not Manchester or Nashua.
I have two more big questions for you. Shelley, thank you for that one. Here's an email from Preston. This is for you, Keith. He says, why can't Liberty House accept homeless veteran sex offenders? I have a friend who is living out of his car because he can't find a decent place to live. I hope to hear your response. Well, here it is, Preston. Thanks for the email.
Well, right now, we can't accept sex offenders because we are part of the Manchester Continuum of Care, and we do receive about $40,000 a year from the federal government, and we are not allowed to have sex offenders live in, you know, federally funded housing. I absolutely agree with Preston's point, though, and I think that we have created this underclass of untouchables who really can do nothing at all. There's no, if you're a sex offender, you're required to report your whereabouts. There are lots of landlords that will not rent to you. You're not allowed in public housing. You pretty much, unless you have some independent means of income, are doomed to live on the street for the rest of your days.
So federal regulations don't allow you to take those folks.
Right.
Okay.
You asked why people are coming to Merrimack County. I mean, the temporary shelters that we have do take in sex offenders.
Okay, so here's the other big question that I have to ask you, and maybe I'll ask you, Jeremy, or Kathy, or Keith. One of the things that did come out in the Concord Monitor series was the magnet question, the idea that if Concord or another town provides generous services, it becomes a magnet for homeless people. Jeremy, there are people in Concord who do feel that we have been too generous.
Yeah.
So shed a little light on that conversation that you heard.
I mean, that's a question we pose to every advocate, every person who works with homeless, and we could never get there definitely is a correlation, I think, among the fact that we've been providing a lot of services and the more we add, the larger the population seems to be getting. Whether or not that means that we shouldn't do it, you know, we are the state capital. A lot of the state resources are here.
Kathy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I really buy that argument. I think sometimes, you know, community members want to say, you know, that's not our citizens, that's not our problem, they're not in members of our community, they're coming from other places. I think if you look at the research, what you'll see is that the large majority of people, wherever they are residing, they have their last permanent address is typically in that same city, or they've been residing there for a very long period of time. I think this goes back to stigma, which, you know, we know that the homeless and the poor in general have been stigmatized in the United States for a very long time. And so, you know, what we need to do is really try to find a way to close the distance between us and them. So the Concord Monitor series, you know, did a great job in doing that and showing these stories. The podcast that Keith is going to be doing, that is exactly what we need. We need to share these stories and help folks to recognize that these are our brothers, our sisters, our mothers, our fathers, our sons, our daughters, and they are our community members.
So you don't buy the magnet story, because a lot of people in Concord anyway do feel that way.
Yeah.
Maybe we've been too generous.
Yeah, I don't buy it, no.
What do you think, Keith?
Well, I just wanted to touch on something that Kathy mentioned, the voicelessness of the poor, that once folks are homeless, it's very, very hard to view. Most of us, you know, nice middle class folks, when we see a homeless person, do not see that there are stories there that are much like our own stories. There may have been bad choices that were made. There may have been bad breaks that life delivered. And that's why I do think that the new podcast that we have called Beyond Spare Change, which is available on iTunes and then also on our website, does give voice to the voiceless. Right now we have 4 episodes up. It's 20 minutes to half an hour interviews with formerly homeless men and women from Liberty House. But listening to those stories, I would defy any listener to say, oh, that's nothing like me. That could never have happened to me. And it really does make real the lives of people that seem kind of surreal to those of us who have a home and have food.
Well, and we've also got a link to that podcast, Keith, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So folks can definitely listen to some of those stories, which we have listened to. Last question for you, I think, Jeremy. The Concord Monitor, after it did this amazing series, pulled together a community conversation about homelessness here in this city, but I'm sure there are themes relevant everywhere. What are some of the ideas that came out of that?
Well, I think the big push here is the Housing First model. A lot of the advocates want to do that, and I think the big question this next year is finding the capital to do it, and that's that's where really the creative efforts are. We're looking for private funding, looking for ways to apply for block grants that are is basically federal dollars, and pushing the state legislators to maybe create some sort of fund here in New Hampshire.
Although state lawmakers like to borrow, raid, you could call it, some of those dedicated funds.
Yeah.
All of you, thank you so much. There's been so much more to talk about. I really appreciate you coming in. Jeremy, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
That's Jeremy Blackman, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor. We've got a link on our website to the Concord Monitor's series on homelessness. Again, our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Keith Howard, it was great to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Keith Howard, executive director of Liberty House, a transitional housing facility for veterans in Manchester. And Kathy Kuhn, thanks as always. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Laura. Kathy Kuhn, director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness. This is The Exchange on NHPR.